Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here today with Russ Chianelli, a co-host from time to time, and we're talking to a gentleman who's going to talk to us about some rather delicate subjects, but in a totally scientific manner, and it's going to be fun. And that is the color of your skin got anything to do with race? You'd say, well, I don't know. Well, Michael Campbell knows. He's a professor of biological sciences at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and he's going to talk to us about this. Michael, welcome
to
Science Studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get into this interesting information that you may have or may not have about color of the skin and so-called race, because we've got lots of experience with it here on the border, and I've been to India and obviously grew up a little bit in England, various issues are going to come out there. But before we get to them, How did Michael become a scientist? Why are you a biology professor?
Well, I mean, I've always been fascinated with biological function of organisms, particularly humans. And my interest really started in my childhood in elementary school and in middle school. I had a strong aptitude for biology. It was one of my favorite subjects. And I can remember when I was about 8 years old, my parents bought me a microscope. And I would analyze anything I could get my hands on underneath that microscope. And I just loved it so much. And my interest in science, I would say, started at a very early age.
So when you remember back, if you can, to that time, what were the most interesting samples that you took?
Oh, my goodness. That
was
very
large. Just things in water, or was it things on dirt?
Well, things in the environment. You'd want to take a look at skin cells, cheek cells, things like that. So anything you can get your hands on that you could analyze and sort of take a look at the microscopic structure was something of interest to me.
So what was most striking that you remember?
Well, looking underneath the microscope and just looking at the cells and the structure of cells and seeing, well, what was inside of the cells. At that age, you have no concept of what things look like at that level. And so to be able to see that at such a young age, it inspired me to want to learn more.
And did your parents look with you, or did they already know?
Well, I would show them whatever I found, I would show them. And, you know, of course, they'd say, oh, that's wonderful, that's nice. But, you know, they were always very encouraging. I mean, I'll say that definitely about my parents. They always put an emphasis on education and pushed me to always learn more.
So where did you finally get an education in college?
Well, I'm Canadian. And I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Toronto.
Oh, my God, man. My PhD is from Toronto.
Really?
Yes.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Toronto is a great city.
I take it you're a hockey fan then.
A little bit. Not so much, but yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that before, obviously. I haven't done my homework. But I often find doing too much homework predicates what the program's going to be
right.
So from Toronto, where?
So Toronto, I then did a Master of Science degree at Oxford University. That was a wonderful experience. I loved that a lot. And then after that, I got into a PhD program at Columbia University in New York City.
Okay.
And I completed my PhD there.
Three pretty good schools.
Yeah.
Toronto, Oxford, Columbia.
Columbia, right. Yes. And being in New York City was fascinating. I mean, you have so many resources at your fingertips. And from a personal point of view, New York is really exciting, you know, especially you're in your 20s and, you know, single and living in New York City.
Well, that's an interesting question. Do you think people who go to graduate school in New York take longer than they really should compared to if you go to Manhattan, Kansas, for example?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't know. Maybe I took a little bit longer, but I don't think I can really answer that question. But yeah, I mean, that's one thing you do have to be careful of because there are so many distractions. But on the other hand as well, fantastic resources and opportunities.
I got
to learn.
My degree in New York, and yeah, it took me many years beyond when I finally got a job. They said, if you don't get your PhD by June, you're fired.
So, well, that was great incentive.
So what were you studying for your graduate programs?
I did human biology at Oxford. So I did an MS, a Master of Science degree in human biology. And then...
Wait a minute. What does that mean? What did you actually study?
Well, now that's very interesting because we looked at human evolution. That was one component, human development, primate evolution, and the connections between non-human primates and humans. So it was a very exciting program, and I learned a lot. The one thing about the British system that I absolutely love is the one-on-one tutorials that I would have with my advisor or supervisor, as they like to say in the UK. And in preparation for that meeting, we'd have to write an essay. write a paper, and then my supervisor would read the paper and ask me questions about it. And that was very new because every week we had our meeting, and every week I'd have to write a new paper.
And you'd have to defend that.
And I'd have to defend it.
The oral component of British education is something that you don't usually get in North America.
That's absolutely true.
I give oral exams, and people hate it.
You know what? It's so interesting that you should mention that, because I'm thinking about giving my students oral exams, and I asked them in lecture how they would feel about that. And of course, I barely got out of the room alive because they're not very familiar and they don't have a lot of experience with oral exams. But I think it's a great way to test knowledge, and you can prevent cheating.
Well, there's that. But you could also train or prepare people for real life.
Absolutely.
Right? You don't week to week, if you've got a job, write exams. You've got to explain yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you publish anything from that master's degree?
No, not from that master's degree. So publication didn't come until later. So I completed my PhD degree in biological anthropology at Columbia University. And that was a wonderful experience as well. I mean, having the opportunity to take classes at the American Museum of Natural History was phenomenal. It was just a great learning experience overall, as I said before. And then I guess if I can jump forward after my PhD.
Well, I'd like to find out a little bit.
Okay.
What did you do? What was the study that you did for your PhD?
So what I was interested in was the genetic basis and evolutionary history of Alzheimer's disease. And so I was focused on two genes that were thought to be associated with Alzheimer's disease. And no one had really analyzed these genes from a population genetics perspective. So what were the patterns of variation within these genes in diverse human populations from across the globe? And so we saw at, you know, some
of
these...
Is there a gene for Alzheimer's?
Oh, yeah, there are. I mean, there aren't... I mean, the research is still ongoing, but they have identified some genes that will increase your susceptibility to developing Alzheimer's disease. And that was what I was more focused on at that time. And so we wanted to understand, well, what are some of these patterns of variation that you see at these genes across diverse human populations? And could these have an effect on the development of Alzheimer's disease in cases and controls. So individuals that have Alzheimer's disease compared to healthy controls that do not have Alzheimer's
disease. So is there a sort of a large data set being accumulated of genetic information on people and later development of Alzheimer's?
Yes. So there are longitudinal studies where individuals are recruited and then followed up over, you know, a decade and more to see if they finally develop the disease or they don't develop the disease. And also genetic information is collected from these individuals as well as clinical data as well. Yeah. So this is something that's really, really fascinating because you can get a sense of, well, what are the connections between the clinical endpoint and the underlying genetic architecture?
We've done programs before on Iceland, for example, because in Iceland they have a phenomenal history of medical records. And they're doing this very much with the genome. And, you know, we're looking forward to finding out, I suppose.
Yes.
But having said that, we're not necessarily any closer to finding how to deal with it.
Right. Absolutely. Now, in the case of Iceland, now, I'm not very familiar with Icelandic populations, but the sense that I'm having is that Icelandic populations are more isolated, right? And so they do have great medical history and medical records, but genetically, they're quite specific and unique because they have been isolated for a long period of time. So the question then becomes, whatever you find in this type of population, could you generalize it to other populations? So, for example, African populations. And so I think that this is kind of an ongoing question. So it's nice to look at these really... isolated populations like Finnish populations, Icelandic populations, and then you ask the question, well, are the results generalizable to others?
Well, that's it. I mean, I've never really thought about this very much because I don't think I've got Alzheimer's disease, although I could imagine I get it quite fast. But having said that, if you've got a genetic issue in one, I'll say race, but population group,
is it
automatic that you're going to have that same genetic imperfection causing a disease everywhere else?
Not necessarily. Because
can you think of an example? I mean, this is actually interesting. Do you know of diseases where the genetic marker is different from population to population?
Oh, absolutely. There are tons of diseases. So, for example, the classic example would be sickle cell anemia, the sickle cell trait.
Yeah, sickle cell, yeah.
Right. So that's a classic example. And it's thought that this trait is maintained in West African populations, for example, in response to malaria. And so you don't necessarily see this trait at this particular locus, the beta globin locus, in a lot of populations outside of Africa, because these populations may not necessarily have had the exposure to the pathogen that leads to malaria. And so this genetic,
but they all have the same issue with the same genetic issue that doesn't produce a certain sequence in hemoglobin. I mean, that's
right. So it causes that sickling shape that you see in red blood cells. Yeah. And so it's related to the protein, the beta globin protein, or the subunit of beta globin. And so that's very, very interesting, because you see this at a higher frequency in West African populations, but you don't see it necessarily in populations that don't have a strong exposure to malaria.
So sickle cell anemia, Englishmen can have this without the genetic trait?
Well, typically you wouldn't find it. You wouldn't find it because that mutation wouldn't likely exist at a high frequency in populations from the UK, for example.
So it would still be the same genetic issue, but it would have been caused subsequently, perhaps.
Well, the reason why this genetic mutation is maintained is it's protective against malaria.
Right.
Right. So the mutation appears in a population, right? And so it's beneficial against malaria, so it decreases your risk for the adverse effects of the malaria parasite. And so if that particular mutation becomes beneficial, so individuals that have the mutation will likely survive, reproduce, while individuals that don't have it will not survive as long, will not reproduce. So you see the shift over time in the frequency of the mutation. And that's because it's protective within that given environment. So, for example, say you shift the environment and you look at an environment where there isn't a strong history of malaria, well, it's not likely that this particular mutation would rise to high frequency because it's not beneficial in that given environment. So to go back to your question, you do see differences in the frequency of particular traits that have evolved in a particular environment, and they might be very different when you go to a different environment, and you may not see the frequency or high frequency of that particular trait.
Well, that sets me straight. So thank you very much.
It's a classic example, and it's one that I use with my students.
Well, I used to teach it in bioinorganic chemistry.
Right.
I mean, the whole chemistry of hemoglobin, all the little variations, and every time there's a misplaced amino acid, it's another disease with a name.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today our guest is Michael Campbell from Howard University. And we're going to be talking about race and color when we come back. But first, this break.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Most of us haven't had surgery, and even if we had, no robots were likely involved. But that is changing. Recently, one robot-assisted surgery really stood out when a robot precisely drilled a hole in the skull.
That in itself wasn't remarkable, except that it took just 2.5 minutes compared to the human surgeon's 2 hours. This was a game changer.
Robot-assisted surgery is now used in orthopedics, obstetrics, otolaryngology, and other specialties. The main reason is that it helps cut down surgical and recovery time, results in fewer errors, and costs less.
In the case of neurosurgery, cutting down the time that a hole is open in a patient's skull lowers the risk of infection. The drill is computer-controlled and is guided by a two-dimensional CT scan that can create a 3D image of the area.
The surgeon then indicates where the hole should be made, as well as the axis, radius, and depth, and then the software calculates the ideal path for the drill to take. The path includes a margin of safety around all important structures that must be avoided.
Safety features include an emergency off switch in case of a difficulty, such as an alert from a sensor indicating a nerve is nearby.
The drill was tested on plastic blocks, then on a cadaver skull. When compared with a manual drill, the robotic drill was more accurate and 50 times faster.
The bonus is the robotic drill is relatively inexpensive, at less than $100,000, and is already headed for production. It's among the growing field of robot-assisted surgery, which no doubt will help improve patient outcomes.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pennell, Russ Chinelli, Michael Campbell from Howard University. And let's get to this business, because color of the skin is so often just sort of a substitute for whatever the word race really means. Let's, from your perspective, as a scientist, as an Afro-Caribbean born in Canada, but with black skin, talk about this. First of all, let's define in your real terms as a professional scientist, biologist, what does the word race mean?
Oh, goodness. So race, I mean, that term can vary depending on where you are. All right. So in the United States, so people have classified groups of individuals based on physical traits. So skin color is one of those traits. And so in the United States, people typically that look like me would be classified as quote unquote African-American. People that do not have my level of pigmentation or that might be lighter, much lighter, might be classified as either Asian or European or of European ancestry. And so you have these groups that are considered to be quite discrete, and the concept of race can be very misleading because it doesn't demonstrate the fact that we are a single species and that there's really more overlap between these quote-unquote races than differences.
Okay, so what's that got to do with color? Because that's the big question.
That's the big question. So there was this large-scale study that was published in Science, and it was a collaboration with my mentor, my postdoctoral mentor, Dr. Tishkoff, and scientists in Africa, as well as other scientists in the United States. And so it was this great project that wanted to understand the genetic basis and evolutionary history of skin pigmentation, particularly in African populations, because African populations tend to be underrepresented in genomic science and genomic studies. And so what this study has shown is that there are alleles that were found, novel alleles that hadn't been reported previously, associated with dark pigmentation in African populations, as well as alleles associated with light pigmentation in African populations. So what we found in the study is that you have these alleles associated with dark pigmentation and light pigmentation in Africa. And so these alleles have been floating around Africa for a long period of time. And in fact, these alleles are quite ancient and predate the origins of anatomically modern humans. And so one thing that we also found in this study is that light pigmentation is something that was present in Africa for a very long time. And we see certain populations like the sand hunter-gatherers in southern Africa that tend to have lighter pigmentation compared to other sub-Saharan African populations, particularly Nilo-Saharan speaker populations in East Africa. And one thing that we've learned is that lighter pigmentation isn't something that really evolved recently outside of Africa, but it's been present within Africa for a very long period of time.
A study that I was just reading saying that humans basically all arrived from Africa.
Exactly, exactly. We go through background information where we talk about the origins of anatomically modern humans, which is Africa. The geographic origin is in Africa.
So, I mean, Russ's comment is correct, because sometimes you read that the Chinese will say, no, we've got evidence that, you know, human beings were first noted in certain parts of Asia. So that's a dead issue. Is that correct?
Oh, well, absolutely, in terms of the fact that science has shown, genetic data have shown that it's likely, most likely, that humans arose in Africa within about 200 to 300,000 years ago.
These alleles that you were talking about, they're sort of indigenous to us when we came out of Africa, and they are the same in all the parts of the world now. I mean, if you go to India, for example, you know, and you've got very clear color demarcations between different societies, very darker in the south and much lighter. But it's all the same allele worn out symptom.
Yes. So I was moving in that direction. So one thing that we found is that the alleles associated with dark pigmentation in African populations exist on a very specific haplotype background. And what we found was that these alleles associated with dark pigmentation and on the specific haplotype background were also found in populations from South Asia and Australo-Melanesia. And it suggests that dark pigmentation didn't evolve independently, but likely the alleles that are associated with dark pigmentation in these non-African populations were inherited from Africans right. that left Africa within the last 100,000 years.
Of course, the scientific question is, why did this occur?
Part of the human exodus
not enough sun?
Well, in terms of levels of UV light, so when you look at South Asia, particularly South India, mm-hmm. you look at Australo-Melanesia, and you look at parts of Africa, you can see that they're on the equator or very close to the equator. And so it's thought that dark pigmentation evolved in these populations because they're protective against higher levels of UV light. And so it's been suggested that high levels of UV light have this potential of degrading folate, which is a very important vitamin that we need because it performs functions related to reproduction. And so having darker skin was protective against degradation of folate. And also, it's believed that darker pigmentation, as you know, is protective against cancer. And so it's very adaptive in areas of the world where you have high levels of UV light. Now, in terms of lighter pigmentation, it's been theorized that lighter pigmentation evolved in populations that live in northern latitudes and higher latitudes because the lower levels of light didn't really facilitate the production of vitamin D in individuals with darker pigmentation. But however, with lower levels of light and lighter pigmentation, you could have that interaction with UV light skin, and then you can have the production of vitamin D, which is very important for normal bone development.
It's fascinating. It's a wonderful topic to talk about.
Absolutely.
In a scientific sort of a manner.
Scientifically speaking, are there actual measurements of the absorption of dark skin and light skin?
Well, in terms of the absorption of sunlight versus that in light skin, I'm sure that other studies have looked at that. I mean, we particularly did not in our study. But in terms of pigmentation, what we did measure was actually the level of pigmentation in these different populations. And then we, again, correlated that with the genetics to sort of understand the connections between the genetics and the actual phenotype that we measured.
Let's go to, you were saying, the other aspects of your work. This is such a big topic, Michael. Right now, you go back to your lab on Monday, you meet your students, your research group. What are you going to be talking about? What's hot on the press?
Well, looking at skin pigmentation and the alleles associated with skin pigmentation in West African populations and also in recently admixed populations like African Americans. And so the question is, well, what alleles contribute to the broad spectrum of pigmentation that we see in African American populations? Is it related to recent admixture with European populations, or are there unique variants, novel variants in West Africa that are contributing to pigmentation in populations outside of Africa, particularly in the United States? And other research questions involve disease susceptibility. So we want to understand, well, okay, so what are the alleles that contribute to skin disorders like vitiligo? So are we looking at these unique mutations in West African populations or mutations in general in West African populations that have undergone a mutation, that have undergone some kind of change that has led to conditions like vitiligo? So we want to understand the genetic basis of skin disorders. Other projects in my lab involve looking at the genetic basis of breast cancer, for example. So we want to understand, well, why do we see a higher prevalence of breast cancer in African-American women?
Is that true?
It's true. A higher, right. Well, and it occurs at a younger age in African-American women. And we want to understand, well, why do we see this this disparity in terms of the aggressiveness of breast cancer and its onset at an earlier age in African-American women?
I didn't know that was the case, but I mean, and there's so many of those questions out there for different Absolutely. Social groups within, I mean, in this area, with a large Latino and Latina population, diabetes is a big issue.
Absolutely.
Is that also in the African-American and Afro-Caribbean sort of community?
It is. Diabetes and obesity are two big diseases in African American.
But that's interesting because we've done programs before on obesity, and the Pima Indian group down in Arizona that have got cousins on the other side of the border in Mexico. Mm-hmm. All right. One society, obesity is, and also diabetes, is a big issue.
Right.
But on the other side of the border in Mexico, no, that's not an issue.
It's interesting.
And then they're sort of pinning that down to junk food. I mean, if you summarize a lot of research, it's just that the diet is so poor.
Yeah, absolutely. Diet plays a huge role in the onset of obesity and diabetes. But one thing that's really interesting is that there may also be a genetic component to it as well.
Predisposition.
Exactly. So you have these alleles that predispose individuals for diabetes and for obesity, but it's kind of like standing at the edge of a cliff. So you've got this predisposition. And so you just
step back.
you could potentially step back. So, you know, if your diet, your lifestyle is constructed in such a way that you're able to step back and then not move over the edge of the cliff. In the other direction, if your lifestyle and your diet are not conducive to that, it's almost like being pushed over the cliff. So the predisposition is sort of the boundary, and then your diet is kind of determining whether you go over the cliff or you don't.
I like that. I mean, because most people, you'd think, hey, you're on the edge of a cliff, there's two options.
Absolutely.
You jump, you can step back. But there are societal forces that, in fact, sometimes push you over the edge. And I'm thinking in particular of, you know, you live in certain parts of North America and certain parts of Western Europe. What you can go and buy for food is very limited. You know, you can't go to a Circle K and get all sorts of fresh veggies, right?
Right.
But that's not quite what you were getting at, or is it?
Well, I think the implication could be what you just mentioned. But in terms of what I'm saying directly, I would restrict it to diet, lifestyle, including exercise, that could determine whether or not you go over the cliff or step back from the cliff. What other factors that are going on that contribute to lifestyle and diet? That's
something
beyond
else. Your pay grade.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Your discipline.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a final question about your research.
Okay.
Do you study anything where humans have gotten traits from animals?
So diseases that shift from one host to a new host. Now that is fascinating, and I'm very, very interested in that. So a really recent example would be the Ebola virus.
Ebola, yes.
Right. So the jump from the bat species to human species, and it's very interesting because when you see a jump like this from a viruses from one species to a new species, the effect can be sort of unpredictable because the new species doesn't have a long evolutionary history with this particular pathogen, and the virulence could potentially be very high. So when you see this transfer from one species to another species, I think that's very fascinating, and just trying to understand the evolution of the pathogen. So one question that I would love to be able to explore is, when the pathogen shifts hosts, do you see novel genetic mutations that enable the pathogen to survive within the new host? And so do we see, you know, signatures of natural selection where variants that will facilitate survival being selected for in the pathogen? So that's an area that's fascinating, and I would love an opportunity to be able to explore
and,
that.
And I think that fits in with so much that we know about what are often called orphan diseases.
Mm-hmm.
We say, well, that's not in North America, so we don't worry about it. But, you know, given modern travel, modern capacity for little viral pieces to be caught in a dust piece and then migrate all the way across to North America from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Hey, Michael, we've had a lot of fun. You're the first Canadian-born, Afro-Caribbean guest we've had on Science Studio.
Oh,
and you've got a certain way of handling this subject that you're dealing with. And it's easy to ask you these sorts of questions because these questions are important. And I thank you very much for doing the research and being here on Science Studio.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thanks to Lauren Terezes as our producer.
We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Take care.